Thank you, Jay, but I certainly don't expect the men to stand up when I come into the room. Please be seated. If we go to the second slide, Al, thank you. It is not that one, but the one before that, back to working on ourselves, because I really didn't get very much to ourselves. I spent a little too much time. There we go. James, as the coach, if we could just go quickly through some key parts of James that I would like to draw your attention to. The first one is in chapter 1, beginning with verse 2. He says, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds." You ought to have an assumption already in your life that, as Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation. In the world you have trials. No one gets out of it without trials. And as Peter says, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that comes upon you as if something strange were happening to you. This is demanded, this comes upon all the body of Christ, every Christian. Resist the devil, James says, firm in your faith, and he will leave you. But James is talking about trials that may or may not have anything to do with the devil, but various kinds of trials. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness, that is, do not short-circuit the process that God is allowing the trial to come into your life for. Do not short-circuit it. Run away. Quit. Let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect, perfected, brought to the fullness of the person God intends you to be, complete, mature, lacking in nothing. He picks this up again in verse 12. You see, James is more of a coach than he is a professor who goes through something systematically. He has these little turns. He suddenly turns and says some little jewel, some specific thing. Verse 12, he picks up that theme of steadfastness when he says, "Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him." Then suddenly he turns and says, there is something that's different than a test. It's a temptation. You may remember that Jesus in the Lord's Prayer taught us to pray, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." That translation, which most of us have memorized, sometimes is confusing and leads people to misunderstandings. Because James is going to say, God is going to remind us that God tempts no one. Well, if God tempts no one, then why does he say, why do we pray, "Lead us not into temptation"? Jesus, you know, after the Spirit of God came upon him, was driven out into the wilderness by the Spirit, where he was tempted by Satan. God led him to the place of testing. But here's the thing that happens so often. When God is testing us for our good, Satan is close at hand to tempt us for our destruction. So one way to look at, bring us, I was teaching the women this because we were going to the Lord's Prayer. Do not bring us to the test, O God. Do not bring me to the test, but if you must, because you know it's for my good. When that happens, do not leave me in the hands of the evil one who seeks to destroy me. So James now switches from testing to tempting. Let no one say when he is tempted, as opposed to a test, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. How many of you are old enough to remember Flip Wilson, the comedian, who used to get always a laugh with the line, "The devil made me do it," after he talks about something that he did? James recognizes that you don't have to blame the devil for every temptation that comes upon you. We sometimes give him way too much credit. There's enough within each of us to lead us into temptation. Sometimes we kind of like the temptation. As St. Augustine said in one of his prayers, "Deliver me from lust, Lord, but not yet." So, Lord, lead me on into temptation. But darn, look at what just came up on my computer screen. That really is a nice picture. Let's look at it big in a larger state. Let's blow it up on the screen. And then that leads to another click. It leads to another click. And pretty soon we're on a porn site. And pretty soon we're on there on a regular basis. And one of the things that's really a sad thing in the church world today is how many men are caught in the trap of temptation. The devil didn't lead you there. The flesh is enough. There are three enemies that we have that feeds the one dog in our lives: the world, the flesh, and the devil. But there's enough in the pressures of the world that bring temptation to us. And there's other temptations that come from within the old person who still resides there, along with the spirit. It amazes me that the spirit doesn't depart from us as believers just because we give way to temptation. He continues to work. He continues to grieve. He continues to woo us back to God. So James is drawing us to a work to do in our lives, that reminding us that often the pathway we go down one step at a time. So, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person, verse 14, each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. You know, my brothers, many clergy are falling today into the trap of inappropriate behavior with women, some inappropriate behavior with men, and one after another are falling like dominoes. And the same thing with lay ministers in the church. And I can only imagine for you all out there in the world, you're confronted with this stuff all the time. And so let us be vigilant. As the book of Proverbs says, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. And one of the reasons why we often need a group of men with whom we meet on a regular basis to pray is because we need those men who will help us and hold us accountable to the things that can draw us so quickly away. Pray for me, brother. You see, the AA groups are so effective because people can open up their lives to one another. And we can't do it on Sunday morning. It's just not the time and the place. But so Watch what he says here. Verse 14. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. So if you find yourself going down this road that he outlines here, do not let the devil keep you stuck in that. Your own desires may have gotten you there, but once you get there, he is, you know, Satan, the name means the accuser of the brethren, the accuser of God's people. And he loves to accuse us and say, this time you've done it. This time you've done the sin against the Holy Spirit. Do not believe that lie. It's not true. If you have a desire to be with God, the Spirit of God creates it. And do not believe the lies that you've done that which cannot be forgiven. No such thing. The sin against the Holy Spirit is the hardened way of calling what God has done good, for our good, for our wrongdoing. So, then let's go up to verse 19. Know this, my beloved brothers. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Oh, I wish I could learn this lesson. My beloved brothers, let everyone person be quick to hear, slow to speak. Especially in my own family, I wish I was better at this. Especially in my marriage, I so quickly defend myself and start down a road of self-defense that gets me in a place I don't want to be. I may have told you this story. A couple of years ago, I bit my tongue really hard. I can't remember how it was that I did it when I was eating. And so a little callus grew up over that place where I bit my tongue. And then I bit it again, which means the callus grew even more. Then pretty soon, the callus grew to such a point that I was always biting my tongue right there. And pretty soon, a growth came on my tongue, which was always being bitten by me. So I went to the dentist. The dentist says, I'm going to send you to an oral surgeon. So I went to the oral surgeon, and the surgeon cut it off. First, he anesthetized my tongue, thank God, because, you know, the tongue is the most sensitive part of the body just about. So he anesthetized my tongue and clipped off the growth, which was at the very tip of my tongue. Then he took some gauze and held my tongue until the blood stopped. But something happened that he had to leave the room, and he had his attendant take his place. And he says, she's going to be holding your tongue now with this gauze. She's going to be holding your tongue for about 10 minutes. But don't worry, she's a professional tongue holder. James is saying, you know, as believers, men, you need to be professional tongue holders. Because a whole fire, a forest fire, can be lit by a tongue that's loosened at the wrong time and speaks the wrong thing. And be careful when you're angry how you use your tongue. Be quick. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. Then he says, and then put all filthiness and rampant wickedness, remove it, put it away. Paul says, put off certain things, put on certain things. The two are saying the same thing. And receive with meekness the implanted word that's able to save your souls. And then later on in the same verse, the same chapter, he says, religion that cannot bridle the tongue deceives the heart. Religion that is pure and undefiled, verse 7, before God the Father. His division, orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. That is, true religion sooner or later has to issue in compassion for the world. Which brings us now to the next slide. Working in the world. Jesus in the Lord's Prayer taught us to pray, "Thy kingdom come." To pray, "Thy kingdom come," is to pray that God's kingdom will come into the world, intervening in the world. And we cannot pray that prayer without also asking the values of Jesus, the King, and his kingdom to come into the world through us. We are citizens of heaven. As citizens of heaven, we are to form colonies in the world, beachheads of a new order. That's what the Church of God, the Church of Jesus Christ, is to be, a beachhead of the kingdom of God in the kingdom of darkness. And one of the things that we are called to be is ambassadors of that kingdom to a broken and hurting world. There's a church historian by the name of Rodney Starks who has written about the rise of Christianity in the first four centuries. He documents how it was that Christianity won the Roman Empire to Christ. And in he says several things, but here's a paragraph that I thought was well worth reading when we talk about working in the world. He's describing how Christianity became a heavenly counterculture to the culture of the Roman Empire. He writes this in a book, The Rise of Christianity. He says, "Christianity revitalized life in the Greco-Roman cities by providing new norms and new kinds of social relationships able to cope with many urgent problems. To cities filled with the homeless and the impoverished, Christianity offered charity as well as hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis of attachment. To cities filled with orphans and widows, Christianity provided a new and expanded sense of family. To cities torn by violent ethnic strife, Christianity offered a new basis for social solidarity. And to cities faced with epidemics, fire, and earthquakes, Christianity offered effective nursing services. For what they brought was not simply an urban movement, but a new culture capable of making life in Greco-Roman cities more tolerable." And the early church, you know, one of the reasons why they won the empire for Christ, along with all those things, is they had babies. Most Roman citizens were so concerned about their own life that they had one or two children because they didn't want children to interfere with their way of life. So they only had one or two children, just enough to carry on the name. But the Christians had many children, and not only did they have many children, but they adopted the children that were left on the dung heaps by the ones who didn't want any more children. If they wanted a male and they got a female child born, the female child's not carrying on the tradition, they put the child, the little girl, on the dung heap. And the Christians would go and gather them and take them home. It was a totally different way of looking at life. And so they were out in the world transforming the world, not through media blitzes, but through day-to-day living a life of compassion in a broken world. the cultural values of the kingdom as Jesus spoke about them in the Sermon on the Mount. So he calls us to be witnesses in the world.
I got a text message from one of our priests yesterday. I'll just read it to you. It's from Ron Greiser up at Resurrection Surfside. He said, "I wanted to let you know that I will be unable to attend the men's summit tomorrow as we have a special food and aid distribution on Saturday." I wrote back, "The theme is a work to do. I guess you're doing it."
God bless them. There's people in the community of Surfside that can't make ends meet, and they offer food and clothing for them on Saturday, on this Saturday. So they made the decision to do the work in the world rather than just come and listen. Stephen Hainsworth is here. Stephen, come forward, would you, for a moment? You all have been reading about what's going on up in Conway and other places in North Carolina. And I realized when Stephen sent me an email that we did not have anyone in the diocese as a coordinator of disaster preparation and disaster relief. And Stephen just retired from a job in which he did a lot of organizing and all. So he just happened to be the right man at the right time. And thank God. I'm going to have him say a little bit about what they are, who they are, and what they're about, and how you might be a part, if God so leads you, to helping out in the relief. Stephen.
So a week ago, Wednesday, we went up to North Carolina to see what was going on with the hurricane. Basically, in North Carolina, the hurricane came in under with a lot of strength in the wind, and so there was a lot of tree damage and some surge damage along the coast. And then as it got in, then it was flood damage. South Carolina, we're seeing all the flood damage, very little tree damage. So the needs of the communities in North Carolina, we need some chainsaw groups to go up there, and we also need mud out, which is where you go into homes that are flooded and clean them up. Anybody can join us. I'm part of the Anglican Disaster Preparedness Relief Group, and it's an organization that helps coordinate people. I'll be in the back, and I'll have some forms. What I'm looking for is an individual from each church to be a leader. I don't want to get overwhelmed by everybody sending me a name. I'd rather have each church have a coordinator. They would create a list of people that can go to South Carolina, North Carolina, and help the people that need help. We can make care bags. We need some supplies, and that will come later, but that need hadn't gotten here yet. The immediate need is when the water goes down is to go in and mud out, which is to cut the sheetrock out, get all the supplies, everything out of the house, clean it up so we don't get mold. So go back to your church and encourage your men and your women and all to donate a couple, give up a couple of days and go with us. We can go to Conway. We've got a station up there. We can put up 30 people in that community, and then we can work with another Impact Ministries is going to go out in the community. So we're trying to work together. We're working with the Diocese of the Carolinas, Bishop Steve Woods. We went up with them to see North Carolina. We've got two other bishops up there that we're working with. So the Anglican Church is kind of reaching over everybody. We're pulling everybody together and using our own resources to help everybody. It's not just the Anglican Church, but we're reaching out in the community. We got there, and they needed a stove in Grace Church in North Carolina. We were looking and assessing it. They didn't have a stove because they were redoing the kitchen, and we needed a stove in that place so we could bring up a group. So we went to pick it up. They had ordered it, went to Lowe's. They couldn't find it. They started to walk out. I said, "No, let's not walk out. Let's just go back there and buy one, the existing one. We'll grab one and take it back." We installed it. So now they're ready for receiving teams. While standing there, a couple was there, and they asked me how I was doing. I said I was okay, and I asked her how she was doing, and she burst into tears. she'd lost everything. And that's how it is with a lot of people up there. They've lost everything, and they need hope. She had no hope. So we prayed with her, and we encouraged her that, you know, we'll come alongside of you, and we love you, and we can help you. But I need a leader. I need people to sign up, and then I can coordinate the teams to go to different places. We can put you up. We'll feed you, baths, showers. We've worked all that out. So get involved. Please come out and help.
You know, some of you have heard me perhaps tell the story of maybe 15 years ago, if not longer. I was asked to teach a class at a seminary on the history of Christianity in England. And it was one of these intense classes that started on Friday, 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock. And then it went on Saturday from 9 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And then again on Sunday. So the students would read all month long in preparation for the lectures that would take place on Friday, Saturday, for the weekend. And it was connected with a seminary, and some of the students were taking the classes because they wanted a Master of Divinity degree, because they wanted to be priests. And in order to be a priest, in most cases, you have to have a Master of Divinity degree. So they were taking the class for credit. But we had in the Diocese of San Joaquin, where I was, also vocational deacons, or what permanent deacons order, in which they didn't need a Master of Divinity. They were only taking the class in order to be prepared for their diaconal exams. We have a stand-up chip. Chip's a vocational deacon, you see. He doesn't have a Master of Divinity. He probably doesn't even have a Bachelor's of Arts, but sit down, Chip. Okay. But he does have a heart for God, which is why God has drawn him into servant ministry in the world. You know, a deacon is supposed to interpret the needs of the world to the church and the resources of the church to the world. That's what they're called to do. And people who are called to be vocational deacons have a heart for being out in the world with compassion for people in need. Well, anyway, so some of the people were taking the class, just auditing the class and preparing for their exams. Well, anyway, you can imagine if you've got to make it through the whole history of the Church of England in 3 weekends, you're teaching at a very fast pace. And so I began that first evening, we're talking about how Christianity first came to England through business people, most likely connected with the Roman Empire, when the Roman Empire went all the way up to Hadrian's Wall there in northern England, and many of the Christians were what we would call British Romanized believers in Jesus. But when the Roman hordes, the pagan hordes, the Germanic tribes, began pressing in upon Rome in Italy in the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries, the Roman Empire pulled out their soldiers from what we think of as England today. And the Germanic tribes began to invade. The Anglos, the Saxons, and the Jutes began to invade England, and they drove the Roman British Christians up into the hills of Wales. And they did not try to evangelize the invaders. They fought against the invaders, and they lost. And some of the Roman British Christians were pillared and marauders from Celtic Irish, Celtic barbarians came and took some of them, like Patrick, into exile as slaves. Eventually, Patrick got away, was reconnected with his Christian life, and went back to Ireland in order to convert the Irish Celtic people. Well, that all happened in the 4th, 5th, and then on to the 6th century. In 597, Pope Gregory the Great in Rome sent Augustine to Canterbury to evangelize the Anglo-Saxon barbarians. They eventually met up with the Irish Christians who were evangelizing northern England in a place called Whitby. And in 664, there was what was called the Synod of Whitby, which ushered in 400 years of Anglo-Saxon Christianity. And during those 400 years, you had the Viking invasions. And so I went into all of that and how that affected things. And then in 1066, the Normans invaded, and there was the Norman invasion, which was successful. And after the Battle of Hastings, of course, then Norman Christianity became the Christianity of the day. And I'm walking through all of this stuff. We're going at breakneck speed. It's 2:00 on Saturday afternoon. We finally take a break. And this person comes up to me and says, Father Lawrence, how much of this do I have to know? I said, are you auditing the class or are you taking it for credit? Well, as it turned out, that next Sunday morning, the gospel reading was a Sermon on the Mount. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. You know how all of that goes. And then after that, you know, it goes into, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. If your left eye, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. And on and on. And he who hears these words of mine and does them is like a man who built his house on rock, and the rains came and the floods rose and the wind blew and the house stood. But the man who heard these words of mine and doesn't do them is like the man who built his house on sand, and the rain came and the floods rose and the wind blew, and great was the fall of that house. And I couldn't help but think, as I was hearing the words of the Sermon on the Mount being read, you know, it probably took Jesus an hour and a half to give that sermon. Can you imagine someone coming up to him afterwards, one of the disciples, saying, Lord, how much of this do I have to know? Can you imagine Jesus saying, are you auditing the class or are you taking it for credit? When we're talking about work in the world, we're talking about not earning our salvation, but taking the course for credit, putting it into action. And one of the ways that we can put our faith into action, of course, is witnessing to people about who Jesus is. Frank, would you come forward? You know, we had several weeks ago, maybe it was a month and a half ago, maybe it was 2 months ago, I don't remember when it was, but we had a workshop on evangelism. Sponsored by the Evangelism Committee of the Diocese. And we have another one coming up on October 20th at Trinity Church in Myrtle Beach, if the roads are clear by then, right? I think they will. I just have one or two questions to ask Frank, but you have a bunch of these cards.
I do. Yes,
okay.
Sir.
And it's just the event about the evangelism workshop. If they attend an evangelism workshop, what will they learn?
They will learn much about themselves through a very brief questionnaire that pins into or looks into their personalities to determine what particular style of evangelism is pertinent to that personality. So they'll learn a great deal about themselves, sir.
How many different styles of evangelism are there that they'll learn?
There are 6, according to an author, Bill Hybels, who wrote very nice books. 6 different styles, depending, again, on the personality. And knowing which style, or in some cases, 2 styles, suit you best, that will equip you better for the work of evangelism.
Okay, so they'll learn there are 6 different styles, at least, of evangelism, and which ones they may be most fitted to use.
Indeed. That is the purpose.
What will they do?
They will have an opportunity they will learn of these styles. They will have an opportunity to discuss them in small groups. They will have an opportunity to practice evangelism under the guidance of people who know a little bit more about it, perhaps, than they do, and we'll have great fellowship.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So, October 20th, it's a Saturday workshop. It's from 10 a.m. to 3:30 at Trinity Myrtle Beach. Have you ever witnessed to Jesus Christ in your life, to another person? One of the most moving moments in the New Testament is when the man who was born blind is healed. And he's being interrogated by the Pharisaic leadership there in the synagogue. And he goes through a series of stages where when he's first asked who healed him, he says, a man named Jesus. They come back around because they're concerned that Jesus healed this man on the Sabbath day. And they say, well, you know, this man is healed on the Sabbath day. He can't be a godly man. What do you think? Who do you think he is? The man says, he's a prophet. They come back a third time. They want to ask him again, tell us about this healing. And he says, why? Do you want to become a believer too? Now, who do you say this man is? We've got to know because we don't think he's a man of God. And they have already threatened to drive his mother and father out of the synagogue. So they said, look, don't ask us. He's of age. We don't want to get involved in this. And they come back a third time. And they said, look, I can't answer all your questions. But this much I know. Once I was blind and now I see. That is a powerful witness in today's world. You don't have to answer all the questions, but sometimes you do need to say, once I was lost and now I'm found. Once I was blind and now I see. And how many times we go through our day and we have an opportunity to do that and we don't take advantage of it. So one of the things that's our work in the world is to bear witness to Jesus Christ and just say what he's done. Later, you know, Jesus comes back to him at the very end after he's thrown out of the synagogue. And Jesus says, do you believe in the Son of Man? And the blind man says, who is he, Lord, that I might believe in him? And Jesus says, I whom speaking to you am he. And he believed and worshiped. So witness in the world. It's open our mouths at the right time and let God speak. I'm going to ask Father Imad Mata to come forward. Father Imad is from Egypt. He's a priest in the Diocese of Egypt, North Africa, and the Horn of Africa. He's here with us for the week. He's been up at the Anglican Leadership Institute in Martha's Vineyard, where it was held this month. But Imad is in a country that is, what is the percentage of Muslims to Christians?
Christians are between 10 to 15%.
And Muslims then would be 85%?
Yeah, at least.
And you live in Cairo?
Yes.
What's the population of Cairo?
About 100 million. Cairo, 22 million.
22 million people in the city of Cairo alone. Can you imagine that? 22 million. It's wild and crazy, is it not, in the highways? You minister in a church in Cairo?
Yes.
Tell us what the church is called by God to do.
Yeah, and when you enter the cathedral in Egypt, we have a stone in the shape of a Bible and open on the page where it is said, from Egypt I called my son. Mm-hmm. You know this verse comes from Hosea 11, And it is quoted by Matthew about Jesus Christ. So Egypt is one time it was the oppressors of the people of God. In second time, in days of Jesus, it was the refuge for the Holy Family. It was the refuge for Jesus escaping Herod. So what is Egypt now? It is both. We are oppressed in Egypt, yes. We don't being killed all the time, all the days. We live freely. We go to the church. We worship. Sometimes there is some accidents happen there, and mainly in villages. But we live. We are good. But our church in Egypt has a privilege to be a refuge for Christianity in the Arab world. We are both obsessed, we are both persecuted in a way or another, but we are a refuge for the Arab countries. We work in, as Bishop said, we work in the community, in the Anglican Church is a small church, small denomination in Egypt, but a very influential one. We work in the social ground. My church is a social center-based church. We help the poor. We give illiterate classes. We give teaching for women, many things. And we give them also spiritual maturity, spiritual things. We are involved very much in the dialogue with Muslims. Bishop Munir is very much, is a very influential person in this dialogue. We work in the ecumenical work between Christians, each other. We want to live for Christ. We want to reach Muslims in our community. We want to reach even Christians. We have at least 10 to 15 million Christians. Most of them are Christians by name. I'm born Christian because my father is Christian, and we have the in the ID we have the religion. So most of Christians are need to be reached, but it is not only that this is our focus. We need to reach our country. Many of Muslims are coming to Christ in the last 10 or 20 years. Many, I met many, I know many of them are coming to Christ. God is working in amazing way between them. Sometimes he uses us in evangelism. Sometimes he just gives them visions, gives them dreams, gives them. God is working. God is in work. And God challenges us to work with him. Mm-hmm. And not only in Egypt. We founded 10 years ago, we founded our seminary. And one of its goals to enable Christians to take the gospel to the Arabic world, because we have the advantage that we speak Arabic, we know the culture, and we can reach them. The seminary is not just serving the Anglican church. At least maximum third of the students are Anglican, but most are just Christians who want to serve God.
Father Ahmad on the drive out was telling me about how one of the things they offer at their church is clothing and nursing facilities and all sorts of what we would call social ministries. Yeah. But a Muslim woman had a bunch of very nice clothing that she wanted to give to the poor.
Yeah.
But she went to Ahmad and said he wanted to give it to the church rather than to her mosque.
Yeah.
Why do you think she wanted to give it to the church as opposed to the mosque?
Because she has been served in the church, and she realized that we don't differentiate between Christians and Muslims. When we need to help the society, we don't look to the name or to the if she is a Muslim, you know that Muslims in Egypt,
yes,
or a Christian. We just help the people in need. Hmm. So, and she trusted us. She trusted that we will give it to anyone who only need it.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop.
We have. Thank you, brother. I appreciate you being here. We have a relationship with the Diocese of Egypt, North Africa, and the Horn of Africa. It's one of the many dioceses and provinces around the world with whom we work. But I wanted to bring Imad up because he's in a country where you cannot evangelize in the same way that we can. They have to do it through their actions in the world. James would be very proud of their ministry there because they are showing, they have no way to show their faith except for by their works. And it's by the works that God brings people and enables the church to grow. So they started out as a service center for the needy in Cairo, and now God has brought people who want more than just food for their bodies and clothing. They wanted to be clothed with the gospel of Jesus Christ and wanted to eat the bread of heaven. And so now they have a congregation there as well. So God bless you. We're going to take a break again for another.